Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Total Celebrity Show. Just two segments. You can go to my website, TotalTutor.net, for more information. Twitter, Total Tutor. Neil S. Haley, Facebook. LinkedIn, Neil Haley. Instagram, Total Tutor. Pinterest, Neil Haley. And Google Plus, Neil Haley. And we got a really exciting guest today, Rico. So I want to welcome the program my co-host, Rico Rakowski, Just Two Choices segment. Rico, how are you? And I know you're excited about our guest today.
I really am excited about Doug Glidden. Doug, I've had some Detroit connections from a while back, and never had much to do in automotive, but I'm just excited as heck to talk to you today. Former USAC sprint car champion, and now in racing in the National Hot Rod Association Top Fuel Dragster class. And this is an amazing feature of Doug. He's ranked in the top as one of the top 10 drivers every season since 1998. So, Doug, welcome.
Yeah, thank you for having me on today.
Well, it's great to have you on the program, Doug, and I know that Rico has a lot of questions, as I do as well, about this, and especially drag racing in general. Am I right, Rico?
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the first questions that comes to mind, though, Doug, you know, is, you look at the background in terms of sprint cars and midget driving. I mean, how do you make the leap? How do you make the jump from driving and being a champion, like in sprint cars, and then you're into these the top fuel dragsters where you're going, 330 miles an hour, 1,000 feet in 3.7 seconds. How do you make that leap, and how do you start out to do that?
Yeah, it was an interesting opportunity for sure. My cousin actually was driving the top fuel car at the time. But yeah, I stepped into his team. He decided he was wanting to retire, and so here's a championship team looking for a driver. And, I was running sprint cars and midgets and working with the business. And, make a long story short, there was a short list and I got my name on it. And unfortunately, the guys gave me a shot at driving this thing. So I kind of went straight from running sprints to running top fuel cars. I was able to go to a school for a day. Frank Holly has a great drag racing school, which that was made it a lot easier. Ran that thing, and then I had Ed McCullough, who's been in drag racing for a long time as my crew chief. So, obviously with all the support with Connie and everything there, I had a great group to learn from. And yeah, it's a different deal for sure. Running sprint cars and midgets, you certainly a lot more seat time. But for me, just having the opportunity to run up front in anything is kind of what I'm all about in some kind of auto racing car. So that's kind of the short story, I guess.
Now, Doug, that's interesting when you talk about specifically the transitioning to a higher level racing. That's pretty much the way the racing business works, right? You go from one level to the next level to the next level in your process to get to the top, correct? You start by learning the ropes by driving even go-karts, am I correct? Is that true, Doug?
Yeah, I drove those. And obviously the car control that you learn, racing any go-karts or midgets or sprints, to step into a dragster, I mean, they're certainly not moving around like a sprint car, a Terre Haute or anything like that. So, it's just the speed, is what the huge difference is as far as the car moving around. That doesn't seem too bad, but it's just that acceleration. And these races, to 1,000 feet it's just a pretty short sport kind of deal that, it's incredibly competitive. So, so that's kind of what drives me to stay out here and, keep trying to win these things. Kind of shoot for this championship. Hopefully this year we'll have another good shot at running for the championship. So far, so good.
Sure. It's kind of fascinating. Doug, my background is in aviation. And, of course, when you start in aviation, everybody starts out flying small airplanes and Cessnas. And I ended up in F-16s. I was flying F-16s up at Selfridge, up in Mount Clemens. And that's how I kind of got introduced to Detroit there. And when you step out of the F-16, you step into something that's a little bit, obviously a little bit slower, there's a big difference. And then when you step back into the F-16, you step into this massive acceleration. So what does that feel like to go from sprint car? I mean, obviously, you know, when you move into the drag, top fuel dragster class, I mean, the rocket ship
acceleration
in that is pretty phenomenal. Not to mention you're being graded on your not only on your lapse time, but also on your reaction time. Could you tell us more about that? What goes on in your mind?
Actually, interesting you say you were at Salford there, because I grew up on like a 4 mile final my whole life.
Salford Air Force Station. So that's kind of what I had the opportunity to work with Tommy in his aviation company. I had watched jets my whole life flying in the Salfords, and and it's just still a very active base, but.
Yeah,
that's very cool that you flew in and out of that base a little bit. But the acceleration is really what you have to get used to. I mean, you know, your first couple months of driving this thing is somewhat of a blur because, you know, next thing you know, you hit the gas and you're at the finish line. So it's, over time, you get more adjusted to, more of your surroundings, I think, but it's a blur. I mean, I have to admit it's a blur. You line it up straight and obviously, and I think that's the biggest part of driving these things is it's going to go the first 100 feet, kind of the direction you have it lined up. And the dragster is sort of like, it's very sensitive. So it's nothing, it's sort of more like flying that F-16 than it is driving a funny car. A funny car, you have to really steer those around. But the dragster, real light, sensitive, kind of just kind of thinking about where you need to be and not getting the car moving around. So you don't want to oversteer the thing because it upsets the car and the tires. So, but it's a cool ride. You know, if you ever have an opportunity, I would highly recommend it.
Like
flying an F-16, man, it would be.
What if you get queasy, Doug, in cars and stuff, or in like certain types of roller coasters and twists and turns? That's not the type of thing for you to do dragsters, is it, Doug?
Yeah, I tell you, I was more nervous driving going to that top thrill dragster, to your point, than I was the first time driving my top thrill car. My car doesn't do that, that flip at the top. So far it hasn't anyway, that's cool.
One of the interesting things that I've talked to some friends about, again, because of my association with Detroit and through the Selfridge and then meeting people in the automotive industry across the board, including some racing people, they've been talking about these latest things, like they have in airplanes now. They have these little black boxes that, as I understand, you guys have to wear in your body that senses the amount of G-forces and monitors your body functions. Are you guys using that now in the dragsters?
No, we're not. We've got a deal that's mounted to the car. It's mounted to the car. Yeah, not mounted to me. But really, all that data is there to access through our computer system that we monitor all the different parameters that that we can monitor on the car. So it's all good information for sure.
How many G's do you feel when?
And it's about 5 G's.
Do you know how many G's you feel?
It's about 5 G's acceleration.
Wow.
Probably just a little less than that if you use both parachutes. I mean, usually if you throw both parachutes out, you normally got to get pushed off the track. I mean, it's very effective. So I just use one.
Doug, when you talk about the speed of this compared to a race car or an Indy car, or a Formula One, whatever type of car, it's just like you're almost close to feeling like you're in the speed of light, right? When you get in there and it goes, right? You're like, okay, there's no time to think. It's just like, bam, right? Pretty much like,
yeah. That's it. I mean, you see that light, you aim with the gas, and it's pretty much an instinct. From that point on, if the car shakes or because it's pretty much you put it to the floor and it has a sequence that it goes through, and if for some reason it smokes the tires, or shakes, or that's when you really want to get off the gas and try to gather it up. And that's kind of just all an instinct. It's really hard to, it happens so fast. You know, you just got to get the same hook back up. So, and that's another thing that differentiates some of the drivers. Some guys can catch it real quick and, you know, and get the thing going again. And some guys obviously struggle with it. So,
yeah.
Wow.
But it's pretty stuff.
Amazing.
You know, and then right now we're going a little under second, over 100. And then the eighth mile is about 290. And then up to the finish line is about 320 to 330 is kind of the range of what this thing does in 1,000 feet. So it's one of those sports that, you know, it's watching it on, if you actually come to an event, staying in the grandstands, it's a whole different sensation than actually just watching it on TV. It's one of those sports that it's good to witness in both places for sure. You know, to come out and actually see and feel this thing, because, you know, just the sound and, you know, the thrust of the thing going down the track, it keeps the fans coming back for more, I guess.
Well, it's the number two sport and motor racing. And what's the horsepower that you're putting out, you know, when you punch it like that? I mean, it's got to be enormous. Yeah. That's nitro methane. So
yeah, they calculated it out to be 10,000 horsepower out of a 500 cubic inch, you know, 8-cylinder engine. So,
Doug, what do you think makes the sport so popular? As Rico brought up, second number two in motorsports. What it makes that sport so popular with the crowds and people to check you out and so yeah.
It's all the things that, you know, we've been talking about. Just the sound, the speed. You know, it's close racing. The older you get, the your attention span probably gets a little bit less and less over the years. So, I mean, it's very fast pace, you know, and plenty of action. So, but it's one of those kind of cars that people look at and go, you know, I would just, you know, some people would be like, just not going to get in something like that. So it's kind of an intriguing type of, you know, racing for a lot of people that look at this stuff and go, you're just crazy to do it. it's competitive and it's fun. So, and we got a lot of great fans. With the NHRA. You know, we've got the U.S. Nationals coming up. It's our biggest race of the year. And like I say, we got an opportunity today to test at Indy. So we're here. We've made like three runs so far with my car. Actually, they're getting ready to roll up here again to make another run. So, yeah, we got the big race going up here Labor Day weekend. So, you guys get a chance to come out, I'll give you a front row seat, except for behind the wheel of my car.
Yeah, that's about as close as you can get, isn't it?
Yeah, we'll get you right down to we'll get you standing on the starting line. That's usually, I remember when before I even drove these things, so I was like, well, I haven't been to a drag race in a while. I've agreed to drive this thing. I'm going to go check this thing out. And I tell you, I was like standing on the start line going, what in the heck did I just sign myself up for?
But that's a great lead-in, Doug, because one of the questions that comes in my mind, you know, all of us, you know, Neil was a professional wrestler before and we're involved in all these other things. He has a family and we all have families. And, you know, at any time during the day, we've got 15 things going on at the same time. Yet when you're going to step into the cockpit, I guess I'd call it, of a top fuel dragster, and you're about to go 320 miles an hour plus in 1,000 feet in 3.7 seconds, you got to be focused. So how do you prepare for that? Is it days before the race? Is it, you know, how do you get in that rhythm so that when you get there in that 3.7, 3.6, hopefully, seconds of fame, you're totally focused and you don't have any of these upsets or, you know, everything just steers right down the center?
Yeah, you know, it's a great team effort, drag racing. Really, it's the way the cars are set up. Everybody plays a very important role. So, you know, it's not, you know, I'd like to make it sound more difficult than it is. I mean, you obviously, on Sundays, you know, eliminations, trying to get good light. You just got to, you know, you just got to want it worse than the other guy. It's really what it boils down to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
you just got to feel it that you're just going to go up there and go when that stupid light comes on. So, and then the rest kind of takes care of itself. I mean, it's, you just keep it in the groove and go. So, so yeah, that's kind of the approach that I take. I mean, it's all about my whole team. You know, I got Max Wolf behind me, and
sure,
just everybody that supports this effort. You know, we're just out there. You want to win these things, and so that's kind of the mindset. We're going to these races, and we're going to win it, and you see where you end up. But it's a pretty exciting sport, and it's a family, you know, a big family sport too. Like, you know, my uncle Connie Fulton, who grew up right next to Selfridge Air Force Base, you know, he's been out here, and then obviously I wouldn't be out here doing what I'm doing without him. He's been, you know, he's part of my racing, supporting my racing, you know.
Right.
Very beginning of running go-karts. So it's a lot of family stuff going on out here as well.
So how much of a mentor has he been for you, Doug?
A huge mentor. Obviously, even like with the aviation stuff, it's great finding, you know, people that just want to do stuff. You know, that's the way I was when I got around the airplanes. I wanted to learn how to fly, work on them, race them. So, you know, just he's given me the opportunity to just get in the mix and excel at something that, and that's half the battle is, you know, in anything is finding, you know, the opportunity. You know, but it's really up to the person to take advantage of an opportunity. And, you know, that it's cool when you know, when you can excel at something, and you know, I'm sure he's pretty proud of what he's, you know, given me as far as opportunities, and you know, and then you take advantage of doing it right, and that's still what we do with the aviation stuff as well. I work with him during the week, you know, with our airline businesses, and so back and forth between airplanes and race cars, it's a lot of fun. I have to admit it. That's the best of both worlds for sure.
So it's interesting, Rico. Yeah. You like that whole idea of airplanes with the relationship with airplanes for Doug, right? Especially Rico is he flies a plane. He's a commercial air pilot. So
Rico does?
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. I switched out of. Transitioned out of Selfridge from F-16s and went to Southwest Airlines flying for them now. And, of course, you know, your uncle's air freight side is legendary in the business. It's kind of interesting that's why I get excited about Detroit. Anything that has to do with motors and, you know, and pioneering in technology when it comes to automotive is fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, Southwest is a great company, it seems like.
Definitely, Doug. And I think that Rico has a little bit more of a question. What was the question, Rico, you have for Doug?
Well, it really just had to do with the, you know, the Detroit and that whole scene of engines all the way around. Like recently, just about, I don't know, 10 days ago, didn't you guys have that Woodward Dream Cruise? There's drag racing associated with that, isn't there? Didn't they do something to where they had, were you participating in that?
I didn't participate in it. It sounds like a great effort with, you know, some drag racing, organized drag racing there at the Silverdome, and the Woodward Cruise is, there's just a ton of people that come and actually do that. So, but yeah, with our business or with my business there in Detroit, we support, you know, the big three, particularly with their assembly plants around the country and world. So, mm-hmm. That's a big part of our business, and being right there in Detroit, you know, moving whatever quantity of parts around to keep the production of these vehicles flowing through their assembly plants is what we do during the week. And so it's cool that I live in Detroit, you know, and then obviously working for those guys in kind of a niche type of business, you know, to support them. So they can keep, because, you know, whenever they shut down an assembly line, you know, they costs are just staggering. So
yes.
Being able to use Learjet Falcon 20s, I just bought a 737-400. I guess you're probably pretty familiar with those. it was a passenger plane. I bought some Ukraine. I converted it and we're getting, I just added it to my 121 certificate. I've been running these 727-200s, supporting the automotive group with those. And I think the 737 will do a good job. It'll certainly be more fuel efficient. So, the aviation stuff is, is just a lot of fun. I've been fortunate to be able to use use our jets to go back and forth to the races and I stay current in our Lears and we got about 20 different Lears, the 30 and 35 and 36s, so I stay current in those. The Falcon 20, we got about 10 of those, mm-hmm. and I've got a little over 10,000 hours, so I'd love to fly that F-16. So if you ever. Well, you actually have the Blue Angels up in Michigan this weekend, so I'm still trying to figure out how to bum a ride with those guys. But
Off air, I'll give you some clues.
And then, like today, we blew our senior down from Detroit, so we're things are just a workhorse. It's like a pickup truck for us.
We're definitely Yeah, we'll definitely get you guys connected off air, and I will connect Rico to your publicist, and we'll get that going for sure. I could see Rico say, "Let's see," because especially the two relationships, you guys are both crazy. I'm crazy too. I mean, anyone that flies fighter is a fighter pilot or is a drag racer. Forget about it. And then look at specifically a dragster, and then think of me and myself as a professional wrestler. All of us at times are thrill seekers for sure. And I think that's a thrill seeker.
Hey,
go ahead.
Hey Neil, at least we wore helmets. You don't wear a helmet. You hear
things. Yes. Whenever we see professional wrestlers with helmets, then I'm going to say forget that sport altogether. Now, here's some amazing driver facts for Doug, and this is the thing that. Learning your sport, you're educating me today completely because honestly, I have nothing that I've been interviewed of only a few driving people, and I want to bring that up at the end of this. And this is a very somber fact, but driver facts: 37 career wins. You're 42 number one qualifiers. You ranked 15th all time. Three-time championship runner-up, 2003, 2004, 2006, and top 10 in point standings every season since 1998. So what is your major goal now? What do you think, Doug, you can accomplish? Again, we look at this season already. You have three final round appearances, fifth place in the current point standings. What do you want to accomplish? You're definitely one of the stars in this sport, but you would love to be the best, right? I'm sure that's why you do it.
Yeah, the championship at the end of the year has been the thing that I've been lacking here with drag racing. So that's definitely our goal. And they do a playoff thing after this next race at Indy. They will reshuffle everybody's points. And I went into last year first with six races to go, and I ended up fifth. So and then it's kind of a crapshoot really for the last six races. Our team car, they started the countdown 10th and ended up second. So you just have to put everything together. For those last six races, just consistency, going around, didn't win. So we're going into a fifth this year.
So
that'll be our goal. So, these last six races for the season, it's consistency, obviously going around, and hopefully the championship. That's the one thing that's missing from my drag racing resume. So. We're going to be working real hard at accomplishing that this year.
The championship. And I know Rico has one major question to ask you at the end, and we always do. But one thing is, I also know you have an announcement for our listeners out there. Doug, you have a new sponsor you want to mention. Tell us about that new sponsor, and then then Rico has a final question.
Yeah, actually, we're going to be the Walt car at Indy. So we're going to go and do a wrap. Sticker wrap for the car, and obviously it'll be yellow and the wall colors. And and they're a big part of Stanley Black & Decker. They're actually the parent company of Mack Tools, which is my typical sponsor throughout the year, supporting the Mack Tools distributors. And so, yeah, a special car at Indy, a DeWalt car, and, you know, it's going to look great. And hopefully we're going to make those guys proud with the U.S. Nationals win. But it's pretty exciting for us, actually.
All right, Rico. He has a little survey he always does at the end of the interviews of his celebrity interviews. Yeah. And I can tell you, you guys really hit it off. You guys definitely have a definite kin relationship when it comes to speed, for sure. But, Rico, go ahead with the question you have for Doug. Yeah.
Now, Doug, we ask all our guests, and there's no right or wrong answer to this thing. But, you know, the idea here is in every moment, you know, there are just two choices, and you're going to make – you know, one choice that's either going to take you closer to what you want, or you're going to make a choice that sometimes could take you further away from what you want. But every moment has that opportunity for a new choice. So how much do you feel, what percentage of life do you feel is choice, and what percentage do you feel is circumstance? Is it 100% choice, 80% choice? How do you look at life? How do you perceive it in terms of choice?
Yeah, you know, being a business owner myself, you know, certainly for me, it's kind of driven around the vision of the business that I'm building with the team that I'm building. So I guess I'm kind of in a fortunate situation that
90 seconds
choice for me. So, you know, circumstances, you know, it's obviously a big part of it as well. So, just taking advantage of, you know, making good decisions, chasing good opportunities.
Right. But if you had to pick a percentage of choice to circumstance ratio, just your guess.
60 seconds.
There's no right answer. We just asked the question. Yeah. Yeah.
60-40. Yeah. The choice leading the way.
60-40. Okay. And okay. Can you elaborate on that 40%? What would you say in circumstance in life, Doug, with 40%? 60% is your choice you make, but what about the 40%?
Yeah, just trying to make the best out of, you know, what you're dealt. So sometimes it's, you got to clean it up. So.
The cards you're dealt, Doug. I understand completely. Well, Doug, where's the best place where we can find information on you and learn more about you? Where can we go?
It's ColettaCharters.com. That's my aviation website.
10 seconds.
It would be ColettaMotorsports.com for the racing.
All right. Well, Doug, thanks for having me coming on the show for Just Two's Choices segment. Enjoyed our conversation, and best of luck to you, man. And thanks again for calling.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks for having me on, guys.
All right. Take care. All right. Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Doug.
See you. Take care.
It.
Bye-bye. All right. You're listening to Total Celebrities Show, and we'll be back in just a minute. Hi, everyone, and welcome, welcome, welcome. I'm really excited to welcome you to the Total Celebrity Show, the Just Two Choices segment. And you can go to my website, TotalTutor.net, for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, TotalTutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, Google Plus. All right,
sounds
cool.
Good, man.
All right, cool. So, Vance, I tell you, it's great to have you on the show and excited to talk to you today. And I tell you, looking back the days, watching you as a Denver Bronco, it was such a treat, especially with the three amigos and everything. So how are things going?
Well, I'm blessed, man. I've actually been excited about talking with you on your show, too. I know we've had a chance to visit here over the last couple of months, and we finally put this thing together. I'm blessed. I'm doing great. I'm living in sunny Florida, but it's really humid. They should have told me coming out of the Rockies that when you go down there, it's really nice and tropical, but it's hot.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you're used to that hot time when you started your career. Where did you grow up, Vance?
Well, you know, originally I'm from Trenton, New Jersey, but made our way out to the Tucson, Arizona area when my father was stationed in the service, and finished high school and college there as an Arizona Wildcat. It's always over 100 degrees, but it was a dry heat, you know. And then once I had a chance to go on top of that mountain in 1985 to play with the Broncos, I was used to that snow. and now here I am again in the heat, but this time I'm sweating in like I'm in a microwave.
Well, Vance, I'm excited to welcome my co-host, and again, he's from Denver as well, and he's an airplane pilot, and he wrote a book, and he really is a big fan of yours, so I'm going to welcome the program. It's now we got on the line Rico Rakowski. Rico, how are you? And Vance is on the line already, so say hello to Vance, and we'll go to our first question that you have for him.
Well, thank you. Hello, Vance. It's an honor to chat with you. You know, one of the great Bronco wide receivers, and Neil probably talked about it, you know, player in the famous drive and one of the three amigos, number 82.
Thanks. Rico, what's up, brother?
Well, you know, I was looking at your background here. You know, one of the fascinating things I found, you know, Tim Brown, as you probably know, was one of those guys who had a background in like four or five different sports and lots of an athlete in different ways. And obviously he applied that up to football as well. And I'm excited to read about your fantastic background with regard to long jump, you know, your gold medal at the Pan Am Games and those kinds of things. So my question ties into football, of course. And how did that preparation fit in, to wide receiver?
That's an interesting question. In fact, I completely forgot that I won the Pan Am gold medal for the long jump. I even forgot. I only remember that I was in the, I believe it was the 88 Olympics or 84 tryouts, and I ended up getting a fourth place, got beat out at the last jump of the night. But when I was growing up, I really loved track and field, and running was my thing. I was kind of a scary cat, so football wasn't my thing. But after they had a chance to watch and see how fast I was running, they said, well, if we can get this guy with a football in his hand, maybe he'll be too scared to let guys tackle him. And that's kind of what happened. So track and field has always been my first love. When I was a freshman in college, I had a chance to go to Provo, Utah, and participate in a NCAA championship. And believe it or not, Carl Lewis was jumping at the time. And I was the 15th place person to qualify for the finals.
Wow.
And on my last jump, for some reason, man, with my faith and my Lord and my Savior Jesus Christ, he gave me wings, brother. And I jumped about 26 feet, 11 inches, and beat Carl Lewis on that time.
Wow.
Wow. So that's something. Wow. That's another claim to fame, Vance, for sure, beating Carl Lewis, for sure.
Carl Lewis was a great one.
For sure. And how would you take your ability in track and field and be able to take it? Were you discovered in football that way, or you played football throughout your career before that, like in high school?
Believe it or not, when I was really young in elementary school and junior high school, they used to have this game called Smear the Queer. I don't know if that's probably not even politically correct to even say that word now, because I'm not trying to say it in the context of, what I mean.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, that was the game that we played, and that's the person that catches the ball, and then everyone's going to run around and try to tackle you. And that was kind of my start when the coaches would see me out there running around and making sure no one was tackling me, and they wanted to give me a shot playing football. And I would quit very often, but it came to a time where my father just really put a lot of pressure on me to succeed in life. And so I ended up playing it and playing it and playing it and broke a couple of arms. But after getting better and better, and as I got in high school, it was just something that I was just really good at.
And it was like, but you had to make a choice in your university that you went to, Vance, based on you wanted to be in track and field too, correct? So when you were in that decision-making process.
You know, that was a really good situation there. When I came out of high school, I was being courted really big by Arizona State University, which is about 99 miles away from Tucson, Arizona, where U of A is, where I ultimately went to school at. Funny story, I had made a commitment to go to Arizona State, and the Arizona State football coach stayed at my house that night and woke up for the letter of intent to be signed, and my high school coach shows up and says, Tucson and the University of Arizona is not going to miss out on one of the greatest athletes that ever came out of Tucson, Arizona. So he told me I was staying home. So we kind of broke Arizona State's heart, and I ended up signing with the University of Arizona and went there, and they were on probation. I was a 15 tailback going into the first game, and how my career started was being 15. You had your first team guy. He ended up, his wife got pregnant, so he had to go home and get a regular job. The second and third team guy was ineligible. The fourth team guy couldn't catch, and we were going to be running pass attack, and so I was the 15th guy, and so I ended up starting, and the rest was history, brother.
Oh, definitely history, Rico, and you look back at his Arizona career and then on to the NFL. But, Rico, I think that the next question you want to go, I know, piggyback on it specifically, is just looking at that his multiple sport athlete, right, Rico?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, what's kind of interesting, I'm going to just sidetrack just for a second. It sounds like there's, you know, several people who've had this kind of exciting background of, oh, come from behind. You're just given this great opportunity. And you know, you've talked to Rocky Blyer about his being the 417th pick in the draft, you know, and making his career take off. And here you are making your career take off as well. You also did track at U of A as well?
Yeah, track actually was my first love. I didn't know how far my career would go with football, but I grew up an artist and loving to run. And so when I was offered an opportunity to go to Arizona and run track, it was a great time for me to be there. I was really, really good in my first year in college, and I kind of shined and made the varsity team. And so track was something that I wanted to concentrate on. I wanted to go to the Olympics, which ironically, back in the 80s, you could not, as an American, be a professional in one sport and a amateur in another sport and compete for the United States Olympic team. So I had to make a choice going into the 85 draft, whether I would try out for the Olympics the following Olympic term and or go into the NFL and have a chance to make a living and pay for my kids. So it was quite a cool. But now you can play a professional sport and represent your country. So things have changed quite a bit.
Yeah, especially with the amateur versus professional. And was that a difficult choice for you, Vance? Because, again, you knew you were a great football player, but you also – how many people get to say that they could represent their country and get a gold medal? So
yeah, you're right.
That had to have been a difficult decision.
That was a very difficult decision, and I had a chance to meet with my track coach and met with my football coach. Obviously, I talked with my parents, and I opted to go to the draft because I was projected to go pretty high up. Even though I was running back in college, they projected me to go as a receiver. That particular year, I was the fastest coming out of, some 15, 20,000 football players in the 40. And so they told me, this year you go, you run against Jerry Rice when it's time to run that 40-yard dash, and you blow him away. And so when I went to the combine and ran, you know, back then they used a stopwatch. They didn't use the electronic. And I ran a 4.18 and a 4.19, and I was able to get drafted second pick or third pick in the second round, and the rest was history. I decided to opt out of track.
Wow, Rico, I tell you, he definitely had a just two choices moment, didn't he, Rico?
Oh, you know, that's a really clear one. And as we talk about choice, you know, a bit later on, we look at life, and this is part of what the show is about, is just talking about in every moment you have just two choices, and to be able to compare one thing to the other. And I think it's really remarkable, too, that you had great guidance to help you walk your way through that.
I did. In fact, the rest of my life has always been about choice and about guidance. And with my faith background and with some of the things that happened to me later on in life, I'm finding myself back in that position when I was young, having to make choices, a choice at my age to either bow out gracefully and die to an addiction or try to fight back and make a choice to have sobriety. And I'm sure if we can get into that.
Oh, we're definitely. We definitely will get to that, Vance. And so kind of we'll continue the story with the Broncos, right? So you go to the draft, you get in the second round. And then we all know even the second round pick is not guaranteed to make the team. And especially when they're making you move from a position of a running back, which we know is to wide receiver, it's not always the easiest thing because some running backs can't catch the ball out of the backfield. So Vance, going into, you know, learning a new offense, learning a new system, or learning a new position, how did you prepare for that?
You know, the tough thing about that was I wasn't used to running down the field and making moves and catching the ball as soon as you turn around. And also they had the quarterback that threw the ball the hardest in the NFL in John Elway. So it was quite a transition for me, and I thought initially I'd get there and play some special teams, do some kickoffs and punt returns, be a specialty-type player, maybe do a little bit of running back stuff and put me out wide. So I was a project player going in there, and Dan Reeves was the head coach at the time. And believe it or not, Mike Shanahan was the wide receiver coach at that time.
Oh, wow.
He was the one that decided to draft me because of my speed. And Butch Johnson, I don't know if you remember Butch Johnson.
Yeah, I do.
He was a starter. He was a Dallas Cowboy, then he moved over to the Denver Broncos. He was a starter when I got there. Steve Watson was also starting. But with this new era, you know, John wanted some speed. He wanted to be able to throw the ball up in the air and get it down the field. They drafted me. And as a result, I got a call about 5:30 in the morning, one Sunday morning. I didn't know if it was going to church or what, but Dan Reeves said, I need you to meet me in the office. Oh. And he told me, you're going to be my starter. So it was quite a journey. And my first game I started was against the San Francisco 49ers. And the first real play I had to catch the ball was a flea flicker. So John had a chance to test that arm out right away.
Wow. And Enrico, we'll talk about this. I'll have a question about this. But as Vance is talking about, John Elway throws one of the hardest balls ever that's ever been in the NFL and stuff. And when he throws it, you feel it. And if Vance wasn't used to catching the ball, he finally figured out that for sure. And we'll get to that, Vance, for sure. Now, Rico, it's interesting looking so far with the story of where Vance has gone in specific position. He made the right decisions, and bam, he's in the NFL playing for the Denver Broncos, Rico. So there you go. We're at that part of the story. But I know you have another good question.
Well, the other thought that I'm really amazed about is all the way around is the chemistry that you guys had. You know, the chemistry between you and John, and also the chemistry that created the three amigos. So if you could just share with us, I mean, that initial chemistry, like you said, he had you out there work with you on the flea flicker and those kinds of things. What was that chemistry like? What was that rapport like? And what's it like working with John and then come together?
That's an interesting question, and since this is an exclusive interview, I get to be honest and transparent here. The chemistry was fantastic. It's on the field. John, you know, he wanted to be able to trust his receivers. He was a demanding quarterback. He's a demanding man, and he's a winner. And, you know, that shows now because he's the, you know, general manager and running the operations. But back in those days, John just really expected you to always show up on time, always be at all the meetings, always work after practice, always catch as many passes as you can. He wanted you to have that same attitude as him, and he was a general. He was a leader, and he wanted people that was going to follow him. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of how that chemistry started. And after we had some success, we went on to draft Mark Jackson, actually, in 86, mm-hmm. rather. And then we drafted Ricky in 1987. So here we are, three young guys, bullets, they called us, really fast and able to get John and spread the field out and throw the ball. Unfortunately, the dynamics with Dan Reeves at the time and John weren't as good because John wanted the air out all the time, especially when he had these three young, fast wide receivers. Now, since we didn't throw the ball a whole lot back then, only when it was time to come back and win the game, me and Mark Jackson and Ricky Natil, we started to have kind of a rift against each other and weren't getting along because there was one quarterback, one ball, and we didn't throw the ball a lot with Dan Reeves. So Mark Jackson and I, being roommates, we were sitting there watching our television one night, and him and I weren't really speaking, but I was watching a movie called The Three Amigos with Martin Lawrence and those guys, and I came up with a great idea. I said, you know what, Mark? If we go to practice and call ourselves the Three Amigos, it's going to force us to have to get along. And Mark said, what the hell are they going to think three black guys, three amigos?
But the rest is...
I promise you, if I blame it on Elway, they're going to fall for it. And it flew. Now, when the newspaper asked John, well, Vance Johnson said, you call them the Three Amigos, John said, no way, they're the three midgets because they're all under 6 feet tall. So that was kind of funny. Funny story.
Well, I think that's hilarious and that you didn't get along because, again, it's competitive. And I'm glad you brought that up because I guess you got along with Marcus personally, but then getting Ricky so that all three of you together by saying the Three Amigos, and then the media picks it up, and then you got to kind of play the game, right? That's what it's like.
We were forced to play the game. We were forced to have to get in those limousines and show up to places and malls with 15,000, 20,000 people to sign autographs. We were forced to spend time together and get to know each other. So it was ironic. And, you know, it's funny because sometimes when one of us was mad at the other one, one of the guys wouldn't show up to sign the autograph. So, but we shined. We went to the Super Bowl. We made a Taco Bell commercial. We had a lot of fun back in those days.
Wow. But it sounds like for yourself, though, I mean, you brought the speed, the idea of speed to the game. And then, like you said, we talked with Ricky, came in, and Mark Jackson.
You know, the interesting thing about the NFL, it's always changing, always evolving. And when they change the rules, then you have to change the way you either you draft receivers. Back then, they had the 5 yard rule where you couldn't touch them after 5 yards, and so that gave the smaller receivers like myself, Mark, and Ricky a chance to get down the field and get open. And then it got a little bit more physical as the cornerbacks, and now they started to give them more leeway to that from that 5 yard bump rule, and things just really change, and you start going to the taller receivers, to the big, stronger receivers like Shannon Sharp. So the game's always evolving, and it continues to evolve.
That's so true. The game always evolves in so many ways, Rico, and that's the situation. And now, Vance, when I think about Super Bowls, and I think about this is the funny thing I didn't bring up because of how we kind of had to do an impromptu in the beginning because of not connecting with Rico. But one of the biggest things of me is my two favorite teams are the Pittsburgh Steelers and the Denver Broncos. I live in Pittsburgh, Vance, but I lived in Denver. And when I think about this team, the three amigos, John Elway, the disappointments of the Super Bowls. How does that feel for you? Is that still ache in your heart, or is it something that still eats at you that you guys didn't win a Super Bowl together?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You struck a chord there, and I should hang up the phone on you because of what you said. But, I'm sad even thinking about it. You know, my first Super Bowl was in 1986 as a rookie. I was only 21 years old, and I was standing on the sidelines listening to the national anthem. I remember the airplanes going across the top of the stadium, and I looked around at the fans inside the stadium, and tears just came out of my eyes. Because I remember when I was a 7-year-old little boy knowing one day that I wanted to be in the position where I was in the Super Bowl because I loved watching football. And being in that position, I just knew that, you know, with John Elway at the quarterback and the way we were as a team, that there was no way we were going to lose the first game. Unfortunately, I think it was against the New York Giants. We went out there and did really well, but there were a couple bad calls. And then Terry Bradshaw was the announcer. And I remember at halftime, Terry Bradshaw was talking about John Elway, how he choked in big games. And John was watching that on television.
Watching it.
We went out the second half. I swear, Bradshaw destroyed John in that game. He solely took away John's ability to have confidence to go out there and win that game. And not very many people know this story because I was the one that my locker was pretty right next to him, and I watched his face when Bradshaw was talking about that. Go back and look at those films, man, and you'll see how he was talking crap about John. It really affected him.
Well, that's amazing. And Vance, one more question. Well, why did he watch the broadcast? I know it's a long halftime show, but how did he know that's too bad it got in his head? You know, because...
Inside the locker rooms, you always have the televisions on, and it's always on, you know, especially Super Bowl. That's the only thing on television in the country during that time of year. And so there are, you know, several televisions inside the locker room there, and it wasn't like someone was paying attention to go shut them all off. So we started watching it. You know, we go in, we take a break, we sit down, we get some water, we try to revamp and come up with another game plan. We're already winning going in at halftime, and Terry Bradshaw starts running his blah, 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 blah.
Oh wow! So Vance is digging at the Pittsburgh, one of our flagship stations, our Pittsburgh station. I love it, Vance. I'll take that anytime because I'm not. I mean, like I said, Broncos this year. I feel that this is going to be the year, and we'll talk about that later. But Rico, I mean, the story then Vance's career is over in the NFL. Great career, just to summarize, and then I want to get to that. I know you have the next question. And especially the years of the Broncos, and to be able to say that he was in three Super Bowls, what a fantastic opportunity. And then the career goes on, and he finished up with the Broncos, and I know, I'm sure, we want to get to the other part of the story. So, Rico, what's the next question you have for Vance?
Well, just on a little bit, I mean, if I can take it this way, you know, for just a second, you know, you brought up some stuff that we haven't really talked about before, and what I really find fascinating that you're sharing with us, Vance, is some of the behind the scenes things here. So, you know, we've talked about the offense and we've talked about the chemistry and the three amigos and John and coaches and stuff, but nobody talks about the defense. You know, you had Carl Mecklenburg, you had Tom Jackson, you had Rulon Jones. You know, you played with some great defensive players. Do you guys talk to each other?
You know, we did talk to each other. We had Dennis Smith. We had Dennis Smith. We had Steve Atwater. I mean, we had a great defense, and those guys really came up and gave us a big chance to put points on the board. But when you, as a defense, or you know that you don't have a great running attack, there's going to be a lot of three and outs. And we weren't the biggest defensive team, and so they really wore out, especially when we played against the NFC. They wore our defense out to the point where when it came close to the end of the game, especially in the Super Bowls, there was just no way that we can come back to win those games. And the defense was always really frustrated with the fact that since our running attack wasn't very good, our linemen were, you know, suspect at best, and Elway was pretty much on his own. There was going to have to be some change, and I think that's the reason why it was time for Dan Reeves to go, because John needed to have a team that was built around him, not a built around the system that Dan Reeves wanted to run. So defense was frustrated. John was always frustrated. And our last game, we played against the Buffalo Bills. I remember Dan Reeves last year. And when we got on the bus to head back to the airport after the game, Dan Reeves, for the first time in my 10-year career, actually not 10 years at that time, but close to, it was 6 or 7 years at the time, he was not on the bus. And so we knew something was going on. It was just John Elway sitting up front and Pat Bowlen. So these are stories that you're not going to hear about. But I'm pretty transparent, so I'm glad to be able to share them.
Well, I'm glad he's definitely telling some great stories. But now I know Vance wants to talk about this, and this involves, Vance, again, the situation where you hit rock bottom and you made the right choices and decisions to move on in your life and start again. Tell us what made you want to make that choice to move forward in your life through addiction and stuff.
I think my addiction babysat me most of my career, and it wasn't until after my career where I had a chance to own some businesses, and my oldest son was going to college, and because his mother and I were divorced, it was the first time we really had a chance to get to know each other and be close. He was going to college over on the western slope of Colorado with me. I was trying to be successful with business. There was a real estate boom. My kid had a motorcycle, and he had a car. He had blown the engine out of the car, and he decided to take his motorcycle across the mountain to go visit his mother because his grandfather just died of cancer. And I got a call one morning that my son, on his way home, someone ran a stop sign, and he ran into them and died.
Oh, man.
I hate to pause on the show here, but it just brings back memories when I think about, you know, the day I got that phone call. I was standing in my bar drinking a shot of tequila. Ironically, it was 10 o'clock in the morning, but once I got that call that my son was dead, I put the shot down and drank a whole bottle of Patron, and I drank a second bottle. And then 2 years later, I found myself in a coma because my internal organs and everything started to shut down. And once I woke up from that coma, I just didn't really know what to do. And I talked to my dad about it. And he said, you know, Vance, it's just one push-up at a time, son.
Mm-hmm.
The NFL, by that time, my strange wife had reached out to the NFL because I had left her and said that Vance needed some help or he was going to die. And so I got a call from Behavioral Health of the Palm Beaches where Randy Grimes, who used to be a Tampa Bay Buccaneer, worked at. And I lied to him for several months until I just hit rock bottom where I just could not go any further. And the NFL paid for me to get on a plane. By that time, the real estate bust had happened. I lost everything. So I showed up to Behavioral Health at the Palm Beaches here in Palm Beach, Florida. And I took like a training camp, man. I was able to get along with my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, because I'm a Christian.
Great.
I was able to hear his voice because I know that's my sobriety. And I got the tools from anointed hands to help me stay sober one day at a time. And here I am now, 23 months sober. And ironically, I'm back in Palm Beach, Florida, working for the same place that gave me sobriety, Behavioral Health of the Palm Beaches. And I'm here to help save lives, man. This is all I want to do in life is run the good race, make a choice of sobriety, and share my story with people who are struggling out there in addiction. And I promise you, both of you on the air doing this interview with me, addiction is affecting you right now in your family somewhere.
True.
Someone has an addiction that is dying, and they need help, and they need a voice, and they need to know that there's hope out there and that change is possible. I went from the penthouse to the outhouse, underneath the outhouse where the grass grows. And I was able to get back on my feet just like I did when I was playing ball. and I'm sober now, one day at a time. And this is what my life is about. I was just doing research the other day, and I saw that the average lifespan of an NFL football player is between 55 and 60. I saw that 78% will end up
90 seconds
after their career. I mean, I found out that 1 in 3 are going to have Alzheimer's, or they're going to have some type of brain disease. I mean, brother, I got to get this done.
Yes.
I got to get this done before my time is up on Earth, man.
That's it, and you have a mission. And, Rico, that's the mission. And to finish up the show, I know one thing, Rico has a survey, and I think, Vance, I have an idea that I think this about a choice survey. So, Rico, go ahead and tell us about that.
Yeah, you know, Vance, you just led, you know, very much doing research on NFL players that you just, you know, and I really appreciate all your candor and all of your insights on both the addiction as well as, you know, the sports, the football side of things. And we look at choices, and every moment there are just two choices. You're going to make a choice that's either going to take you closer, let's just say, in a positive way to what you want, or you're going to make a choice that's not going to serve you well. You know, and life is made up of all of those choices right here, right now, in this present moment. And so our survey comes down to, do you believe that life, or and there's no right or wrong answer to this, but how do you perceive life? Do you believe that life is like 80% choice and 20% circumstance, or 60% circumstance and 40% choice? Is there a number that you would, based on your experience, that you could share?
I think life is about life and recovery, and it's about 100% choice. I believe in eternity.
Wow.
And while we're here on this earth, we have to serve a higher power, and that's God, so that we can get the message out and know that all we are people who live on this earth for a short time, and if we're not giving back, we are going to die. And we need to leave something behind rather than taking it to our grave.
Well, that's fantastic, Vance, and God bless you and for taking the time. Where's the best place we can find information on you, Vance? Should we Google you? Do you have a website, place for people to find info?
Pull me up on my Facebook, just Vance Johnson. It'll be my fan page, and I'm on there doing videos, man, and I'm always talking about recovery. I'm talking about my career, and I'm just as candid as I am with you right now, except it gets even deeper, brother, so look me up.
All right, take care.
And on Twitter, at Vance Johnson 82, at Vance Johnson 82 on Twitter.
All right, well, take care, Vance. It was good talking to you, and best of luck. Okay, take care.
Love you guys.
All right, take care.
God bless.
God bless. Take care.
Thank you,
take care.